Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. Later in the hour, author David Payne offers insights into his new memoir about his younger brother. The memoir is titled Barefoot to Avalon. But first, if you couldn't make it to Triad Arts Live last month, don't worry, because today we're bringing it to you. On July 27th, WFDD and Triad Arts teamed up with the Arts Council of Winston-Salem and Forsyth County for Triad Arts Live. After guests grabbed lunch at Luciano's Taco Truck and Coffee Park Arts, they headed into the Haynes Brands Theater for an intimate performance. Our guests of honor were the Tyler Nail Trio and you, our listening audience. Eddie Garcia emceed the event.
Today's musical guests are Kike Rodriguez-Pastor, Tyler Nail, and Jonathan Luce. They're all established songwriters and instrumentalists on their own, but they collaborate under the name the Tyler Nail Trio. Tyler has been releasing albums under his own name since 2007, and his latest record is called Feathers. So right now, performing the song Saltwater from the upcoming album, Under Evergreens, please join me in welcoming the Tyler Nail Trio.
A pretty poison, and I a little child, and she was a silver teaspoon missing the poison wild, and I got fever. She was a little river, no stronger than a stream, and she feared the mighty ocean and swore she'd never leave, and I'd stay with her. Always be the first to throw a stone. Never leaving well enough. Love was a bed of flowers, it made a fool of me, and I stayed in bed for hours, too blinded still to see that they were dying. And she was a pretty river, as pretty as can be, and I was a river boulder, too heavy for the sea, and I was crying. Never going anywhere but home. Never go. Left, and she was a mighty killer that took the bluebird's breath and left me bleed. And she was a pretty water, as pretty as can be, and she left for bigger water, still flowing over me, and she still leaves. Say my name. love was the tallest mountain I ever tried to climb. And she was the heavy snow wind that stopped me every time I tried to kiss her. And she was a pretty ocean, as pretty as can be. And she left me in the river, still looking for the sea. And God, I miss her. Muddy water holding down my feet. Meant for missing, never meant to keep.
Tyler Nail Trio. Now, Tyler, from what I understand, the first instrument that you started playing was actually the drums.
That's right.
So when and why did you make the switch to guitar?
Girls.
But girls don't like drummers?
Not as much as guitars. Huh. No, that's not true, I guess. Yeah, I did play drums from a young age. I always had a guitar sort of laying around. My sister had bought a guitar at one point. I played with it. But I think I got my first guitar when I was about 16. And I don't know, I guess with drums, you're always making a lot of noise and you're always kind of full throttle. But I was interested in something that could let me write songs and make melodies and stuff. So, you know, the guitar was pretty natural.
And when did you start writing songs?
I started writing songs. I mean, I when I was a little kid, I would write songs along with my playing drums. I would just kind of make things up in my head. But when I actually started writing songs, like what you're hearing now on guitar, it would be about the same time. As soon as I got a guitar at 16, I just started doing that.
You know, some people, when they first start playing, or focus on emulating others or learning other styles. Or were you learning cover songs and everything too? Or really?
Oh, sure.
Just
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I was doing things that I would never do now. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's hear another song from the Tyler Nail Trio.
All right. So this song is called Georgia, and when I started writing it, it was from this idea that I had met this person who was not a local, and I wanted to try to write something about that person, but it turned out to be the opposite. I ended up writing a song about sort of a picture of, you know, my demographic in Winston-Salem and the local folks such as myself.
Cool kids come around. looks them in the eyes, and she swears she's never been in here before. She comes to me so easily, and takes me like I'm poetry, and puts her skin against my skin, and says, let's try not to do this again. Georgia knows her way around my place. She likes to leave her shoes beside the door. The sunrise burns across her pretty face. She pulls under the covers and she tells me I should go let down the blinds. Georgia wants a coffee on the street and to watch the dogs come out on Saturdays. She likes the city underneath her feet. She wants to smoke a cigarette and swear she's gonna give them up someday. She comes with me so easily and takes me like I'm poetry and puts her lips against my lips and says she's had about enough of this.
Tyler Nail Trio. Tyler, that song is really filled with lots of vivid imagery. It's like you really were painting a portrait of this person. How do you organize thoughts like that? Like, what's your process like? How do you gather all these thoughts when writing a song?
Well, I did become intentionally interested in imagery a few years ago, about the time I was writing Under Evergreens, which you mentioned. Imagery is kind of my... not the most important part of my writing, but one of my biggest interests in writing. And So I keep this little journal, kind of an imagery journal, and as I do things periodically, I just kind of think of things I've seen, things I think are interesting images, and I fill up that journal with them. And, you know, most of the time, songwriting, for me, it kind of pulls out the ideas on its own, but when I need to, I go to that journal and kind of find an image and think, oh, in this context, this image might be really interesting.
You're pretty prolific. Do you, you know, are you waiting for the moment and you have like a time where you write a lot of songs, or are you disciplined in a sense where you, you know, you attack it daily?
I used to be disciplined and then I wrote way too much. Mm. So anymore, I kind of like put it on the back burner. I do other stuff until something in my brain is like, you should write this. And then that's what I do. I kind of wait for that moment where I feel really excited about an idea anymore. Otherwise, I'm just going to write way too much.
Quality over quantity.
Right.
Tell them about the little book you have specifically for imagery.
I just did.
Oh, you did?
He is not listening.
What does the book look like?
I forget what the painting is called, but it has a Van Gogh painting on it.
Nice.
You know?
I was thinking, I need to say something the whole time.
All right, well, speaking of the collaborators, what changes in the songs when you bring these guys in? Now, like I mentioned earlier, Jonathan and Kike both have their own musical output, their own records, and own slightly different styles. With this music, Tyler's a core songwriter. So how do your songs change? Or maybe it's you guys answer. What do you think you guys bring to the songs?
I play the guitar.
Cool.
I don't know. Tyler and I live together, so we kind of and are on the same page of in terms of songwriting in a lot of different respects, and Kike as well. I mean, he doesn't live with us, but we're around each other so much, touring and everything, so we kind of sync up now to the point where a lot of it is natural, and it kind of, I think there was some part of that initially sparked the impulse to be collaborative and to get together in the first place, but then it just developed and cultivated into something more refined the more we play together. So what specifically we bring, I don't know.
Go ahead, Kike.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, you know, Tyler writes the songs, he writes the structures of them, he just brings them to the table, and the three of us, John and I, will listen to them, and we'll just kind of intuitively add what we think feels good, and then usually Tyler will just kind of give his feedback, yeah, that works, that doesn't work, and it tends to work for the most part, but if he's got a specific sound in mind, he'll just kind of steer us in that direction, but for the most part, we just kind of bring our own intuition, you know, and let that guide what we bring to the table, and it tends to kind of fall into place rather organically.
Jonathan, you mentioned that you and Tyler live together. This is called the Red House, right? Do you do your recording sessions there? Tell the audience about the Red House.
So the Red House is up in Rural Hall on Westinghouse Road, or Shore Road. And it's just a house located on a family farm. And we have a full operating studio there, and we've recorded the past three. Well, Evergreen, Under Evergreens is Tyler's going to be released soon, and we're finishing that up and release mine there, and we released Feathers there last year. So, and we've a couple other artists in the area have come by and recorded some. So, awesome spot, really bucolic setting.
Good for imagery.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'd love to hear another song from you guys.
Okay, so I've started this new project with another local artist called Molly Grace. Her and I are doing this duo thing, and when I took that on, I started trying to write new songs specifically for that project. And one that came out was the song we're going to do now. And I liked it a lot, and I was just, you know, curious what it would be like with this trio, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to do Cussing at a Neon Sign.
Shame you have to go. I wish that you could stick around a little longer. I'm not ready to go home. I'd rather get another round, something a little stronger. Will you tell me once again the story of a little kid in tobacco fields, cussing at a neon sign and carving up a made-up name in a driving wheel? Every year that got away, every word you ever dared to pray, that fell apart. Every face you're thinking of, every time you thought you fell in love, and it broke your heart. Will you tell me about the time a pair of kids were running round an apple farm, smoking daddy's cigarettes and hiding mama's garden gloves underneath their arms? And that night you parked a car to listen to the radio by the trestle bridge, and whispered, I don't want to go to Sunday school tomorrow, and kissing on the lips. The days keep going by. It's getting colder. Stay a little while. We're getting old. It's a shame you have to go. I wish that you could stick around a little longer. I'm not ready to go home. I'd rather get another round, something a little stronger.
That's the Tyler Nail Trio performing Cussing at a Neon Sign at the Hanesbrands Theater as part of Triad Arts Live. Stay tuned because there's more of their performance and of Eddie's conversation with Tyler, Kike, and Jonathan. Later in the hour, David Payne, author of Confessions of a Taoist on Wall Street, has a new memoir. It's titled Barefoot to Avalon. I spoke with him about this story of brotherhood, grief, and mental illness. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. We continue with part two of Triad Arts Live. Last month, Eddie Garcia sat down with the Tyler Nail Trio and you, our audience, for an intimate performance and singer-songwriter question and answer session.
So I've heard you're curating a new event that corresponds with our monthly gallery hop here in Winston-Salem.
That is right.
And what is that called?
The Music Gallery.
All right, and what is that?
Well, Tucker Tharpe and I, Tucker Tharpe owns and operates the garage here in town, and he and I wanted to collaborate on an event that sort of celebrated the art gallery and sort of tied the two together. Apparently he had tried it in the past, and we just, he hadn't come up with an idea that maybe worked as well, or just it wasn't exactly thematic enough maybe, but he and I partnered up and we finally came up with this idea. Why don't we just get, you know, weird and build a big frame to put on the front of the stage, maybe blank out the space around it, and create this feeling of like of being at a visual gallery, but create that for music, for a music, you know, environment, and see how people feel about it. So we started that, and we built the frame, and we got it happening, and that's what you can expect out of the event.
So it's like that you're playing inside of a painting, essentially.
Basically, yeah, a living, moving painting that makes noise. We usually have about 5 or 6 different artists come. It's usually like maybe a solo or a duo, maybe up to a trio, and they kind of work in increments of 30 minutes or so. We just have as much music as we can, and it's free, and it's kind of family oriented.
Oh, very cool. Visuals are important to you beyond the imagery. You shoot a lot of video too. I've seen a lot on your website. Tell me about the importance of the visual aspect of what you do, like beyond the songs.
Beyond the songs, yeah. Well, you know, that's like how important is a haircut? You know, yeah, it's as important as is having nice hair. I like to play around with visual art. I'm not that great at it all the time. I've tried painting. I make awful drawings that I could never show any of you. But it's an interesting art form, one that I admire a lot. So I do what I can in it. I explore it and see if I can be good at it. I honestly, Kike is the guy to talk to in this one.
Well, Kike, when you're working on songs with Tyler, do ideas for some of the music videos you've shot, are they coming as you're working on the songs, or does that come at a separate time?
Really, I've only done one video, actually. Now, there weren't things that I envisioned ahead of time, and then I try to execute. Instead, the one video that I did do, we went to Gatlinburg. Gatlinburg. And we went to an arcade, and it looked like a lot of eye candy, so I took up a bunch of footage. And the way back home, I realized that that might make for a really cool, fun video. So we went back home, and that very night, I asked Tyler if we could just go ahead and record a song, Farewell the Deer, and... Anyway, that's how it came together, sort of unplanned. It just kind of fell into place little by little. I didn't even know that it was going to work out. It was more of an experiment. But then it ended up looking okay, enough to share at least.
So with the upcoming recordings, you're trying to break the standard cycle of recording, touring. You're doing like a 7-album cycle?
That's right. It's the album release series. And... You know, I wrote a little thing on my website about this, trying to explain the purpose of it. But like I told you before, when I was really writing a lot, I ended up writing more than I could release in a timely way. So what I'm doing now is kind of trying to step back and catch up with myself a little bit. I do write in albums. I kind of think that way. I write in collections of songs. So... Right now I'm trying to make those collections of songs really exist so that people can hear them and experience them and everything. That's what it is, and that's what I'm doing. I'm putting out Under Evergreens, and as soon as I finish it, I'll be starting another album and trying to knock it out.
How do you know what songs stick together? How do you find that thematic glue?
A lot of it comes from just when I wrote it and what was on my mind at the time. I write all these songs and wait a while to see if they're good or not. And the ones that are good, I kind of figure out what that thing is, what that relationship is that they have in common with each other. And then that starts to look like something. It looks like a picture. It looks like a collection of songs that seem to have come from some kind of state of mind that I was in when writing them.
Well, when you revisit those songs, how do you reconnect with them? You know, because sometimes it could feel distant, right? You were a different person at the time when you wrote something, perhaps.
That can be challenging. I think I have to get a little theatrical at that point, kind of go into that character a little bit and be committed to it, just enough for the recording process, really. It's not something that, I mean, some of these songs I've played so rarely that it's still like they're brand new. It's like I have to relearn them. But even still, there's something in there. There's some kind of philosophy or an opinion in there that I might not relate to anymore. At that point, I just have to pretend to be a younger version of myself.
Well, it looks like we just have time for one more song. Big thanks to the Tyler Nail Trio.
We do appreciate you guys listening to us today. So this song's called Farewell the Deer, and this is the song that you can see a video that Kike made on my website.
Go, the bad ones leave, and there is no one in between. Farewell the deer, you're bound to go. We'll meet again on down the road. The sky was gray, her eyes were blue, and she was on 22. She kissed her hand and waved goodbye and jumped a plane for Yellowknife. She came by way of Baton Rouge with no cards to play and nothing to lose. Her eyes were blue, but sometimes green, just like the one Evangeline. The good ones go, the bad ones leave, and there is no one in between. Farewell the dear, you're bound to go. We'll meet again on down the road. She was a city, nothing to do but somewhere to go. She left her heart in Tennessee and lost her mind in Cherokee. God knows she did, God knows she tried, but she never could get satisfied. God knows she tried, God knows she did, but she said she had a life to live. The good ones go, the bad ones leave, and there is no one in between. Farewell the dear, you're bound to go. We'll meet again on down the road. Setting sun, the more we dance, the more a song, the more we stay, the more they're gone, and the more she'd say, the more she'd need to reap the sown and sow the seed. The good ones go, the bad ones leave, and there is no one in between. Farewell, the dear, you're bound to go. We'll meet again on down the road. The good ones go, the bad ones leave, and there is no one in between. Farewell, the dear, you're bound to go. We'll meet again on down the road.
That's the Tyler Nail Trio performing their song Farewell the Deer at the Hanesbrands Theater for Triad Arts Live. Our big thanks to Tyler Nail, Kike Rodriguez-Pastor, Jonathan Luce, Andy Proctor, and our volunteers, Iggy Livengood, Marley Priest, and John Cirillo. We couldn't have done it without you. Be on the lookout for the next Triad Arts Live. Up next, my interview with author David Payne on his new memoir. It's titled Barefoot to Avalon. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. New York Times notable writer David Payne is known for books such as Confessions of a Taoist on Wall Street and Back to Wando Paso. He has a new memoir out. Barefoot to Avalon, A Brother's Story, looks at the life and tragic death of David Payne's younger brother, George A. It's a book about brotherhood, grief, and mental illness. Ron Rash says, Barefoot to Avalon is clear-eyed and unsentimental, which makes it all the more powerful and ultimately unforgettable. Payne's writing is so captivating that his reader becomes aware of the many years, events, memories, and realizations that he has traversed only when he brings them back to a familiar starting point, a room at the family's beach house where the two brothers share the Piedmont Blues, for example. In Payne's book, memories from the boy's adolescence become guiding metaphors. A foot race and the act of running highlight the difference between pacing and racing, who's in the lead, who wins. David Payne spoke to me from his home in Hillsborough, and we began by talking about this memorable foot race.
Well, Avalon Pier is in Killdevil Hills on the Outer Banks. We used to summer there. We were about 2 miles south of Avalon Pier, and when my younger brother, George A., was 16, turning 17, he was playing, wanted to play football in high school, and he had to run a sub-6-minute mile to make the varsity football team. I used to be a runner in those days, and so he asked if he could train with me to make that time, and so we would take a 2-mile out and back from our house up to Avalon Pier and back, and for most of the summer, I would pace him for about the first 3 miles, and then I would just run my own pace in the last mile. But as we got into August and he was getting into better and better shape, one day when I started my kick toward the end, he picked it up beside me, and I could tell he wasn't going to let me run away from him on this occasion. So he kicked it beside me, and before you knew it, we were in this grueling sort of hell for leather foot race toward the end. And on this particular day, he beat me in the last 15 or 20 yards and just sort of walked away from me. And so there he was, standing in the wash with his hands on his knees, sort of grinning at me as I came up, and I think I was a little bit mad about it, but I was also happy to see him reach that level of conditioning. So that was when the photograph that's on the cover of the book was taken, and at least to my eye, you can sort of see that he has a little gleam of victory in his eye as he looks at me. And he later became bipolar, and this was the last summer before his first episode. It's kind of a before shot, and that's the, I think, a picture of him at the height of his youth and his strength, and before he went back and had this really wonderful football season. That was the first scene that I wrote in the book, and at the time I just thought of it as a particular incident from our boyhood together. And I think it was probably a year or maybe even 2 years into the writing before I realized that it was in some way a guiding metaphor for the whole story, that in a way our lives together had been a kind of race. And sometimes he was ahead, sometimes I was ahead.
You mentioned his grin, and it is quite a grin, as people can see from the cover. And but you go on to describe this grin again and again throughout the book. And those are some of the happy moments in this memoir. And you describe it as this look of happy illegality. And I wonder if you could explain that a little bit more and elaborate on this particular look that he possessed.
Happy illegality, right? Sort of when you're being a little bit naughty and you're maybe disobeying the rules a little bit, and you know that your whoever your audience is, whoever you're grinning at, is going to be charmed by your misbehavior more than they would if you were perhaps behaving yourself with perfect decorum. That's the way I think of that grin of my brother's.
And you've described in this book that at various points you had two, they would sound the same, but Taoists. And I wonder if you could explain that distinction, how it was different, a different definition for each of you.
I've always looked at my brother and myself as I was the Taoist, the T-A-O-I-S-T, and he was the Taoist in that he became a stockbroker. And I think one of the reasons that pun had so much power for me, even though I didn't realize it at the time that I wrote the novel, was because it came from such a deep place in my unconscious and spoke to my relationship with him and themes that ran through our family, where one theme was about pursuing, you know, money and material success, and then there I was wanting to be a poet and to live outside and underneath the money system. So we had very different temperaments and personalities in that way. His led him to the stock market, and he was fascinated with that all of his life. And mine led me toward, among other things, an interest in Chinese Taoist philosophy, which after, you know, reading about that for a number of years, became the basis of the first novel that I wrote, Confessions of a Taoist on Wall Street.
So George A. comes to help you move from Vermont when you decide you need to go back to North Carolina. And you all spend a very memorable 8 days together helping you to move out. And,
yes.
You know, this the course of events that happens over these days, kind of it begins your memoir, and it also is sort of the culmination of the memoir in a lot of ways. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners a little bit about that. And ultimately, that is the catalyst for your writing this.
The tragedy of my brother's death is the central impetus for me to write it. As I said, my brother had had an episode at about 33 years old, and he had gone back home to live with our mother, and years went by. So eventually, I think he was there for about 9 years, and it created a certain amount of tension and strain between us. There was not a formal estrangement, but from being close and from me sort of coming home every time he would get sick and trying to be helpful in whatever inadequate way I could, over time we talked less and less. And so as time went by, my career advanced and I bought land, built the house, and then I had a crisis in my career, and my wife and I were moving back to North Carolina. You know, we were under financial stresses and marital stresses and so on, and I needed help to get back. I didn't know how I was going to do it. You know, hiring a big moving company wasn't within our means at that time. So I was talking to my mother about it, and she said, "Why don't you ask your brother to come help you?" And I think less than an hour after we talked, the phone rang again, and it was George A. offering to come up. So I was extremely grateful. And so that tension, he came up, and I picked him up at the airport in Albany. You know, whatever the tensions that there had been between us, I mean, within a couple of hours, we were in the house together. We were playing music for each other. You know, he was playing me Tupac, and I was playing him Radiohead. And we were laughing and making jokes the same way we had, you know, always had. And so we had these great 8 days together where we took that house apart from the front to back and top to bottom. But as the week went on, we got farther and farther behind schedule with the packing. And then on the final day, probably at late afternoon, we had had the big truck completely filled, and we still had things sitting on the front porch waiting to go in, and the load was just airtight. We could not fit another thing in. So as sort of a last minute thing, I decided to go and get a trailer from the U-Haul place in Rutland, which was near where I lived in Vermont. And I came back, you know, after dark, and we put the last items in the trailer. And I, you know, asked my brother, George A., if he was okay driving it. And don't really recall. He didn't seem to have a problem with it. Looking back now, I think, you know, it was perhaps very poor judgment on my part, you know, given the certain degree of physical impairment that he had, but it didn't occur to me at the time. He didn't have an objection to it. So we were sitting there in the meadow about 8 o'clock at night after I closed up the house, and I tapped on the window of my Ford that he was driving. And he was in there smoking a cigarette. We were both really tired, really, you know, stressed from several days of doing this. And I said, you know, thank you. You know, I couldn't have done this without you. You're a good brother. And I remember he said, "It's okay, David." And I turned away and kind of squeezed his shoulder and turned away and got in the big truck, and we headed out. And I started to check on him behind me, looking in the big side mirrors of the truck I was driving. And so we drove for a few hours that night, and he flashed his brights at me, which was the signal that we had. We didn't have cell phones back then, and we pulled over at a rest stop in Binghamton, New York, and he said he needed to turn in, so we went to the first motel that we came to, and spent the night there, and started out again the next day. And so that was the accident happened about 3 o'clock the following day outside Lexington, Virginia. I was thinking of Hemingway's advice, write hard and clear about what hurts. I've always, as a writer, I think one of the exercises that was given to me in my very early career was to write a letter that says the thing you most need to say and could never say to the person you most need to say it to and could never say it to. Every time I've assigned that to my students over the years, and when they choose to read it back, the classroom becomes kind of like a church. And I think that, in a way, this letter is my letter that says the thing I most need to say and could never say. And I thought if I shared it, my hope was that it would resonate with other people, too.
Author David Payne. His new memoir is Barefoot to Avalon, A Brother's Story. Payne will be the highlighted writer at Readings on Roslyn on Monday, August 10th. The series brings writers and readers together for an evening of fellowship and enlightenment. The event begins at 7 p.m. at the Porter B. Byram Center at Wake Forest University. It's free and open to the public. For more information, visit our website at wfdd.org. And once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. That's our show for today. Triad Arts Weekend's executive producer is David Ford. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes on our website at wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts. Follow us on Twitter at Triad Arts Speak. You can also follow WFDD on Facebook as well. Triad Arts Weekend is a production of 88.5 WFDD, public radio for the Piedmont. I'm Associate Producer Bethany Chafin, and thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.